Our reading this morning is actually from the Washington Post magazine, from an article that I stumbled across one Sunday morning last year while I was trying to get out of the house and come to church, but has never gotten out of my head. It's from Gene Weingarten. He calls it Pearls Before Breakfast, and some of you may have read it in the same Washington Post magazine I did. He emerged from the metro at Lanfranc Plaza station and positioned himself against a wall beside a trash basket. By most measures, he was a nondescript young man, youngish, a white young man in jeans with a long-sleeved t-shirt and a Washington Nationals baseball cap. From a small case, he removed a violin. Placing the case at his feet, he shrewdly threw in a few dollars in pocket change as seed money, swiveled it to face the pedestrian traffic, and began to play. It was 7:51 a.m. on Friday, January 12th, the middle of the morning rush hour. The next 43 minutes, as the violinist performed six classical pieces, 1,097 people passed by. Almost all of them were on their way to work, which meant for almost all of them a government job. Lanfranc Plaza is at the nucleus of federal Washington, and these were mostly mid-level bureaucrats with those indeterminate, oddly fungible titles like policy analyst, project manager, budget officer, specialist facilitator, and consultant. Each passerby had a quick choice to make. One familiar to commuters in any urban area where the occasional street performer is a part of the cityscape. Do you stop and listen? Do you hurry past with a blend of guilt and irritation, aware of your cupidity but annoyed by the unbidden demand on your time and your wallet? Do you throw in a buck just to be polite? Does your decision change if he's really bad? What if he's really good? Do you have time for beauty? Shouldn't you? What's the moral mathematics of the moment? On that Friday in January, these private questions would be answered in an unusually public way. No one knew it, but the fiddler standing against a bare wall outside the metro in an indoor arcade at the top of the escalators was one of the finest classical musicians in the world, playing some of the most elegant music ever written on one of the most valuable violins ever made. His performance was arranged by the Washington Post as an experiment in context, perception, and priorities, as well as an unblinking assessment of public taste. In a banal setting at an inconvenient time, would beauty transcend? The musician did not play popular tunes whose familiarity alone might have drawn an interest. That was not the test. These were masterpieces that have endured for centuries on their brilliance alone, soaring music befitting the grandeur of cathedrals and concert halls. The acoustics proved surprisingly kind. Though the arcade is of utilitarian design, a buffer between the metro escalator and the outdoors, it somehow caught the sound and bounced it back round and round and resonating. The violin is an instrument that is said to be much like the human voice. And in this musician's masterly hands, it sobbed and laughed and sang. Ecstatic, sorrowful, importuning, adoring, flirtatious, castigating, playful, romancing, merry, triumphal, sensuous. So, what do you think happened? Know thyself. Claim your destiny. Choose your direction, write your own future, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Guide your own footsteps in the direction of your dreams. These are the slogans of the self-help generation. The people like us, including us, who define our strength by our ability to be who we are. every bit who we are in a world that seems to be doing everything it possibly can to change us into good little consumers of stuff or ideology, to change us into whatever it is the world wants us to be. These are the slogans we put on posters and we hang on the walls of our doctor's offices, streaming in bold letters underneath images of far-reaching landscapes and soaring eagles. They are slogans of self-reliance and dignity and identity. And though they are hugely overdone and overhyped and touted on television by highly paid hacks in Armani suits, they are slogans that have given one or two of us a reason to hope in the dark night of our own souls. I have needed such slogans in my day. As a young woman trying to figure out how to have an impact on the world around me, most of my life has been involved in one way or another in the sometimes painful, often halting adventure of being and becoming myself. Being and becoming myself. That has been the quest, the challenge, the task set forth not only by all the slogans on every poster in every doctor's office, but also by my mother, who, I am glad to say, unceasingly reminds me never to lose my identity underneath a role like wife or mother or parent or minister. That has been my quest, being and becoming myself. The quest for selfhood is a blessed quest, an essential one even. A great many of us, not unlike myself, have spent huge parts of our lives trying to be and become ourselves. Maybe you're right in the middle of such a time right now, where you can't seem to find your own identity underneath all the demands the world places on you, and you're not sure you know who you are anymore. And so you search. And once you find a shred of identity and a fragment of selfhood you can be proud of, you hold on to it, guarding against all those who would overpower you, against all those whose authority could diminish your individuality or rob you of your strength, against a world that would do anything in its power to turn your unique voice into silence or complicity or cliché. In our quest to be and become ourselves, so many of us, including myself, have guarded ourselves against the powers that be, against the patriarchies and orthodoxies and the ready-made boxes full of ready-made answers. If we are lucky, our guards have been effective, and we have chosen paths for ourselves that make us most of the time proud to be who we are. Proud to have set our footsteps in the direction of our own choosing. Proud to have an identity and a plan that we have no intention of losing sight of. Knowing oneself is, well, a good thing, a necessary thing, maybe even the most important thing. But is it enough? Hold on to that question while I return us to our story. Washington, D.C., January 12, 2007. Underneath the headline of the Washington Post magazine, it reads, "Can one of the nation's greatest musicians cut through the fog of a D.C. rush hour?" And Post staff writer Gene Weingarten goes on to describe the scene. The young man in the baseball cap steps off the subway and he pulls his violin out of a battered case. He primes the tip jar. He begins to play. The young man is Joshua Bell, one of the most accomplished musicians alive. The violin is a Stradivarius. The people are the typical busy rush of D.C. politicos, business persons, homeless men and women, and service workers. It has been said that downtown D.C. is an area where more valedictorians of their high school classes currently live and work than any other place in America. The area around our national monuments and office buildings is a vast network of overachievers. A melting pot that sometimes seems to consist largely of the successful and the more successful, tossed in with a largely segregated body of the poor and middle class. So in typical D.C. fashion, not unlike any other city in America, the people who emerged from the tunnels of the subway that January day last year to greet the boy and his violin were people with places to go and things to do. Bell began with Box Chacon. His hands flew on the bow. His movements were like a dancer, the same movements that brought down the house in great theaters with $100 a pop seats by night were given now freely to busy people in their busy lives. 3 minutes went by of one of the most accomplished violin pieces in the world before anyone so much as paused. And then it was one man. A stop, a turn, and moving on. In the 45 minutes that Joshua Bell played there at L'Enfant Plaza, 7 people stopped to listen. 27 dropped some money in the jar for a grand total of $32 and change, and 1,070 people walked right by without even looking. Weingarten, who watched a videotape of the people streaming by Joshua Bell and his playing on Fast Forward, called it a grim dance macabre to indifference, inertia, and the dingy gray rush of modernity. That's pretty rough for a Friday morning. And Joshua Bell said, it was a strange feeling that people were actually ignoring me. And so they were, totally ignoring him. On their way to this or that, to work or life or school, the people walked right by a virtuoso performance by one of the finest musicians in the world, and I don't dare presume I would have been an exception. 1,070 people were so intent on doing what they had planned on doing that day, getting where they had chosen to go, living the lives they had imagined for themselves, that they were impermeable to even the most sublime music. The people at the subway that day were being and becoming themselves. They were doing their own thing. But they were not just themselves in the good sense, moving forward in the direction of their dreams, guarded against the forces that might try to change them. They were themselves in the very worst sense, untouchable and untouched, cut off from the world around them by the sheer burden of their own plans. Encased in a shell of self-reliance, they walked right through a cloud of beauty and didn't even notice. It's alarming how often all of us do that. Drive right past the morning's first light, too tired to see. Sweep right over life as if it isn't really happening. Would that the incident of a Stradivarius in a subway were an exception instead of the rule? But the truth is that there is much we do not see, much we do not allow in, much that simply escapes us in this world because we are so darn busy being and becoming ourselves. Our generation is not the first to have noticed this tendency among human beings. In the Synoptic Gospels of Matthew and Luke, Jesus throws out a quip that I'll never forget. And Jesus has this way in the Gospels of throwing out quips that just stop you in your tracks, and then there's another one a sentence later. But this one is amazing. He said, reflecting on the blindness of the people of his day and on their inability to recognize their own greed and their own smallness, he said, "We played the pipes for you, and you wouldn't dance. We sang dirges, and you wouldn't cry." Then and now, people were blind to the world around them. Then and now, people have been impervious to the impact of the world around them, both for good and for ill. Then and now, people have failed to see both beauty and sorrow, even when it hit them in the face. We played the pipes for you, but you were so busy doing your own thing that you didn't dance. We sang dirges, but because you didn't have the time or inclination to listen, you didn't weep. Every day, like generations of people before us, we set out from our homes, from our beds, to go to our places along our paths. We set our agendas and we speak our minds, because we must. Because our voices are important and our plans are important, and our presence makes a difference. And yet we too, not unlike those 1,007 commuters and the long-gone people of Israel, are so busy being ourselves and living our lives in our own ways that we walk right by grace and beauty and transformation and sorrow with minimal consideration at best as to whether it might do some good to let those things come in and influence us instead of blocking them out. In our efforts to hold on to our own plans and our own identities, too often we become so encased in our own self-protection that we miss the abundance of this beautiful creation. And in so doing, we miss out on truths that could make us better people. We're so determined to be ourselves on our own terms that we fail to see how the world around us might permeate our hard shells of solitude and change us into something different than we are today. I don't want to live in a bubble, even if the bubble is a nice little pocket of my own creation. I don't want to stick to my guns all the time, especially when the guns I'm sticking to could stand to be unstuck. I don't want to dispense my opinions fully formed and irrefutable, not subject to change and hard like a club over which to beat someone on the head. I want to be affected by the world around me. If I hear a pipe, I want to dance. And if someone's singing a dirge, I want to cry. I want to be changed by the great clouds of beauty and grace that masquerade as ordinary days. I want to be affected by the people in my life. I want you to change me. And I want us to change each other. And I want this church to do more for us than confirm all of our long-held assumptions, conventions, and biases that we bring into the doors with us. I want this place to change us, which means knowing ourselves is not enough. No matter how proud we are to be ourselves and to be self-actualized, or whatever the self-help gurus are saying these days, none of us wants to be self-contained. On some level, every one of us comes to this place hoping even in a tiny way to be changed. We come because we want to be transformed, even begrudgingly. And we come because we know we need one another in order to be and become our best selves. Allowing ourselves to be transformed doesn't mean we have to back away from our convictions. It doesn't mean we become great big balls of mushy clay ready to be molded into whatever other people want us to be. But it does involve some pretty scary stuff, like breaking down walls we've spent a long time building, like letting down our guard, like letting the world change us instead of us always trying so hard to change it. Nobody, least of all a preacher, should dismiss the importance of having an ego. Don't get me wrong. The development of an ego is so vital it takes most of us the better part of a lifetime to get it down. But what if developing an ego is a stage along the journey and not its culmination? What if our quest is not just to be and become ourselves, but to be and become ourselves while remaining susceptible to being stopped in our tracks by the transforming grace of the world around us? Sure, we need to do our thing. We need to go about our own paths. But when a boy is playing a Stradivarius in the subway, we need to stop doing our thing and let the world do its thing to us. Imagine going into a worship service willing to be transformed. Going into a conversation ready to be changed. Or going into a relationship willing to see what road it might take you down. Imagine trusting other people enough to actually let them be a part of you. Imagine doing more listening than talking. I'm not saying this is easy business. Just wondering what it might be like. To be transformed, we have to allow ourselves to embrace the terrifying vulnerability of being touched and being challenged when we don't expect it, don't have time for it, and did not ask for it. To be transformed is to be proud enough of who you are that you can let the world and the people in it affect you, even when it's so frightening you don't know where to begin. I used to think it was my job to be myself. I used to think the grandest quest was for identity, the most important thing was self-knowledge, and to quote that great troubadour of my misspent 80s youth, Whitney Houston, the greatest love of all is learning to depend on me. But these days, the ironic truth is that I have just enough self-knowledge to know how limited it is. I value all of my plans and ambitions and desires just enough to know that they could all be turned on their heads by an unpredictable wind that might take me where I cannot dream of going, in the hands of people like you who have the power to change me into a version of myself I've never met before. It's frightening to be transformed. It involves giving up illusions of control, not knowing exactly what the day will bring and being fine with that. It means that if there are dirges to be sung, we might have to cry even when we don't want to. But it's more honest and better in most regards to live one's life as a porous soul rather than a polished one. It's better to cry when there are earnest tears to be shed than to move blindly through, focused only on where we've decided we're headed. I don't want to be blind to change you can help me create in myself. I don't want to walk by beauty without noticing. I don't want to pass up a chance to cry honest tears, and I don't want you to either. Know thyself. Claim your destiny. Choose your direction. Write your own future. Be ye lamps unto yourselves. Guide your own footsteps in the directions of your dreams. Yeah, maybe. But only if we can do those things with all of the vulnerability and willingness of transformable souls. Only if we can do those things without closing the doors on the world around us and the grace it has to offer. It is my prayer that we all find ourselves, that we all may be proud of ourselves and confident enough to speak our minds. But there is another prayer that I pray in the quietness of my own soul to the God that in my own spiritual practice I know is love. And it goes like this. God, give me no detachment. Let me fall and hurt and fear and wonder. Let me seek and hunger and find and seek again. Let me rejoice and laugh and lose and honor. God, give me no detachment. Let the grace of this world move in me and change me into something new each and every day. Amen.